This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 15th of October 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 53rd edition, the one-year anniversary show of Culture with me, Robert Bound. It's a special one for us, so we've got some pretty special events decided to share with you too. First up, we'll pick the best bits and a bit more from our live broadcast at the inaugural Frieze Masters and the opening day of the Frieze London Art Fairs.
There's quite a lot of sort of loiterers and people who just want to come to see the pictures as they would in a museum or whatever it is. But the first sort of 48 hours, 72 hours of a fair are pivotal and critical, I would have thought.
We'll hear what's been causing waves at the Busan Film Festival.
You know, China is so exciting right now. It's the most dynamic cinema in the region. And this year has been very exciting in terms of genre cinema. There's a whole range of genres exploring, like horror and westerns and noir.
And we'll split ourselves stateside and lakeside, attending a couple of cool events in New York and Chicago.
The philosophy was to use radio as a medium of creation, a medium of art, painting a picture, telling a story, but using the crafted tools of radio making.
Plus, no anniversary show would be complete without some live music, so we'll hear from Electro Songsters' New Look as they perform a Midori House session. And we'll celebrate the return of Book Corner with some wise words from the Frankfurt Book Fair. That's all here on this birthday edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24.
Hi, this is Brian Eno. Congratulations to you, Monocle 24. Keep up the good work. It's your first birthday. Happy birthday.
To catapult you through time into a world that is yet to be.
Why is it that we usually ignore the fourth dimension? You see, we can move in the other three. As the doctor said, up, down, forwards, backwards, sideways. But when it comes to time, we are prisoners.
Cast your mind back, dear listener, to a year ago when producer Katie and I met over a glass of wine under the falling autumnal leaves of Regent's Park at the Frieze Art Fair. It was a match made in, well, a hurry.
We started 20 years ago, there were 30 people in the pub, that was the whole art world. Now, 70,000 people through one fair in 7 days. That's a very substantial sea change.
What's it like having your piece premiered while people are walking around with shopping bags? With nice art in, but shopping bags nonetheless.
I mean, I quite enjoy the contradiction in it, I must say, because it is such a huge gap between it.
The buyers for Asia, for the Middle East, for the rest of Europe, still come to London to look for some of the most important pieces.
Fast forward one whole year, and here we are, it's Frieze time again. And when we thought about what to do this time, and seeing it's also our first birthday, we decided that we had to go bigger and better. So we packed up our bags, wires and microphones last week, and did two live shows from Frieze to celebrate, investigate and interrogate the event. First, we were live from the inaugural edition of Frieze Masters, a fair set up to accommodate an even greater spread of galleries and works and attract a different calibre of collector, perhaps. At Masters, works were being sold from any era up to the year 2000, so we saw medieval gargoyles and Warhols, Navajo rugs and Alexander Calder mobiles, and on first guest Axel Verwoerd's elegant stand, ancient Egyptian statuary and the slashed modernist canvases of Lucio Fontana.
The old art I always loved still, and I looked in the sky of a Turner, like a contemporary Chiraga, or I could see even an early still life, you know, the distance between the objects, like, you know, there's a, I sometimes looked more like to the empty spaces than to the things which are painted themselves. I think it's more all about energy of art, of the spirituality of art, you know, what art changes you, but I think art does change you. Living with art is looking like in a mirror, and at the end you start resembling it, and it creates you, gives you another dimension. That's why I think always very wealthy people always have been surrounded by art, and this is of all histories.
That was Axel Verwoerd. James Brett, the ringmaster of the ever-interesting art circus that performs under the big tent of the Museum of Everything, inaugurated his Gallery of Everything at Frieze Masters. Brett's belief in art made by artists that might not consider themselves artists or whose work was unfairly sidelined was a big part of his show.
I've been talking a lot lately about the alternative history of art, which I absolutely believe exists, because it's everybody who made anything outside of the main educational or theoretical structures. And we show a lot of that at the Museum of Everything. We've done shows here in London. We just traveled to Moscow and we're about to open a show in Paris. And none of those are selling shows. But there's a logic which seems illogical to me, which is that a museum should never be engaged in commerce and also shouldn't have a relationship with collectors, any museum. And that doesn't sound right, because the greatest museums in the world were started by collectors.
I mean, philanthropy is not a dirty word. This is nothing would exist without it, right? In terms of the art world.
Absolutely not. I mean, the best, of course, for a big museum is money. And then second best is probably some artwork. Although they're very picky. You'd be surprised what they reject.
It depends how you frame your notes.
Yeah, absolutely. You've got to know someone, perhaps. But I thought much better a very transparent relationship with the market and say, okay, well, here's a gallery. We're going to show these two artists. They're phenomenal. You've never heard of them. They're resonant. If you want to buy them, fantastic. Any profit we make will go towards the museum activities. And if we don't sell, fantastic too, because actually we've done this great exhibition and showed 50,000 people these artists who nobody really knows about.
Ah, oh, James Brett, what an amusing character. And I went to see Edmondo de Robelant, a Dover Street art dealer with a penchant for French and Italian masters and a classy stand with the gilt frame paintings popped on the battleship grey walls.
The most exciting moment, the most important moment, is sometime during the VIP opening. Whether it's early or late, I don't know. I mean, most likely it'll be sort of post-work hours.
That's a very unionised art world. I never see that coming.
But I think that already within this 1 hour we've seen some very important people come round, and you know, it's a bit of a lottery to know whether people will make the effort to come this far away. I mean, obviously the name Freeze is sufficient to attract all sorts of people that wouldn't normally come to other fairs, and we participate in a number of London fairs, namely Masterpiece, this one, and it's a very, very different atmosphere all of a sudden. So,
yeah,
very
nice
exciting.
To know what sort of how the atmosphere changes. Does this feel like a bit of a fresh air blowing through the fallen leaves of Regent's Park?
Well, you've got to remember that though we're not in the Freeze family per se, we do hundreds of fairs a year. So it's a formula that we know quite well. There's usually a huge rush at the beginning. If it's over the first weekend, normally most of the business is done over that weekend. And then there's quite a lot of sort of loiterers and people who just want to come to see the pictures as they would in a museum or whatever it is. But the first sort of 48 hours, 72 hours of a fair are pivotal and critical, I would have thought.
That was Edmondo de Robelant talking to me for our special live show from Freeze Masters. In a moment, we'll be hearing more from our Freeze Fun Festival, but first, some music. We invited Canadian electro rockers New Look into Midori House to perform a session for us, and here they are with Nap on the Bow.
Like a peaceful animal, I sleep on the bow. I couldn't stay away. So hard to keep it away.
your head, I can see it now, it's coming fast. We can only hope it'll last. I'm forever in a memory all about you and me. All alone in the dark, it's only us in this dark. Get over the horizon, but it's already gone. You and I are an island. Just there, I see a darkness trying so hard to keep it away.
That was New Look with Nap on the Bow, and more from them later on in the show. All right, back to Frieze, and from elegant wall hangings to some more contemporary eyeball pleasers. On Wednesday, we kicked through the leaves for the opening of Frieze London. The fair felt like a maelstrom of busyness and business after the thick-carpeted chic of Frieze Masters. What were people looking at? What were people buying? I asked a couple of collectors what might make it from their shopping list to pride of place at home. First, Anita Zabludovic and her curator Lizzie Nielsen told me about their collecting strategy.
I think there's been a lot of quality in the fair this year, and there's been particular booths that have caught my eye. One, for instance, is Thomas Dane, and the installation of Cara Thurow is amazing. And also there is a booth of Ed Fornelis, the artist, and its installation work, working with digital and really fun and exciting and young. And that's quite lovely as well. And there's been also, you know, substantial works of art that have obviously caught my eye, such as Rudolf Stegel. And as I look around here, I can see obviously some great works. I've seen a lot of Thomas Ruths around, and there's a fantastic installation over there at Andrea Rosen's of Ryan Trukarton, which is incredible. And over there at a wonderful gallery in Vienna called Secondo Horrendas, and that's really great work as well.
Between the two of you, you're a dream team. Anita's just reeled off, Lizzie, a list of works that have caught her eye. Sometimes it's your job to go, nah, isn't it? I think the dynamic between a collector and a curator is kind of amazing. How do you work together when you walk around a fair? How much of it is a discussion and how much of it is gut instinct?
Oh, I'd say it's about 50-50 both ways, actually. We think we're fairly in tune with one another. In fact, that's funny. Today we've really been saying how we know what we're doing now. We really know how to work with each other. And today's been, it's a bit of both, but I do play a bit of devil's advocate sometime, and I'm the one who checks the CVs and really looks at, you know, the backstory. So if there is a gut instinct, we can see whether it's got some foundation. And we try not to be too dragged in by the big glitzy works, and really to look, you know, we're also looking in back rooms and looking around corners and seeing what other things are being hidden away from you as well, because yeah. The fairs, there's lots of blind turns and back rooms to look in, you know, there's lots of things to see.
Yeah, there's many a kind of wise acquisition that's been made in a cupboard, right, that is non-display. And do you have a sort of strategy for tackling a fair? When the sort of gates open, occasionally there's a bit of a stampede. Are you stately as a galleon walking through the fair, or would you get exceptionally excited still by these places?
Well, every single fair has a different flavour to it. And this particular fair this year, we've been quite erratic. And we've been jumping from one aisle to another aisle. So it's not been very organised. But sometimes we can be incredibly pedantic and organised, and other times we just really lose our coordination, and it becomes quite confusing.
Today we also had certain people that we knew we really wanted to see, and they just happened to be at kind of the four corners of the fair. So instead of doing a nice organised kind of regimented tour through it, we had to go back and forth all over. Which, a bit of the human pinball, exactly, which is always makes you feel a little bit schizophrenic by the end of it, because you're not on your own path, you're trying to finding your way through.
Yeah. And obviously with such a, with a sort of focused collection as yours is, 1970s art to the very contemporary art, there's obviously bits and bobs that you think maybe you're missing. Are art fairs great places to discover new things, or do you always kind of have an inkling, because you have relationships with artists and galleries, as to what's going to be hanging at a fair like Frieze anyway?
We usually have an inkling what's going to be hung, but sometimes, and more than often, there are surprises. And that really makes art fairs more fun to be in. And there really gives a good feel factor when you find someone you haven't seen before, a new discovery, and it can sometimes be very exciting.
And it's the same for you. I mean, you sort of say that sometimes you have to sort of go through, check the backstory of works and artists, and is that sort of putting the sort of sobering comma in that sentence?
We're collecting for the future, not just for today, so we really have to be clear about the kind of type of work that we're buying, the type of artist that we're, when we make a commitment to something, that's someone that's really long term, and so you need to know that that artist is going to carry on. But talking about how people work at fairs these days, I think in this year in particular, people, the gallerists themselves have been working really hard. I don't think I've ever had quite so many kind of this is what we're bringing than this year. Like, I think my inbox has been taking a pounding for the past couple of weeks. Really, people have worked very hard to get here, and it, you know, this is a serious time. People's lives are in flux at the moment, and people and the galleries are aware of that, so they're trying to maximise the moment.
That was Anita Zabludovic and her curator Lizzie Nielsen. Collector Valeria Napoleone, with her twin sister Stefania, was easy to spot. And after all, stacked hills are a great height from which to spot the best of the fair. I wondered how Valeria worked the room.
I don't have a specific strategy. Actually, I come here, no plan, no map. I lose my map constantly, and I have to go back and pick another one. But if I have one or two things to see, I know that I'm going to go in one or two things, but no plan whatsoever.
And in terms of your collection and coming every year to this and to other fairs and collecting things, are you always looking to the future, or can you be quite impulsive?
I can be really, you know, very spontaneous when I know the artist. I know if I like something or not by gut feeling, if something engages with me, yes. But then I need to read, I need to see the artist, yeah. I need to do a lot of research behind that. So it takes time. Affairs can function very well if I know the artist already and there is something that is coming up at the fair, that comes out at the fair, that I discover a piece that I didn't know about, and then I go for it because I've done my homework already.
Yeah.
That was Valeria Napoleone. And while we had our Culture Roadshow bus parked at Frieze, I also spoke with Tim Marlowe, Director of Exhibitions at the White Cube Gallery, a Frieze stalwart and an international art powerhouse. What did he make of this year's vibe? And how does he choose what to show?
Every art fair has a kind of core of people that seem to go to most of them, or certainly the big ones. And yet each art fair has its own kind of identity too in terms of the audience. It's usually regional. So in Miami it's American and South American. In Hong Kong there's a lot of Australasians and Asians there as well. And obviously Basel is the most international blue chip. But London, I think we get the most diverse global audiences here. I mean, today, opening day, I've spoken to museum directors, collectors, artists from five different continents. That's pretty wide-ranging.
Yeah. And I want to ask, how do you choose the balance of what you're going to show?
I mean, there's always the thought of, could you make it more project-based? Could you do solo artist presentations? Which occasionally we've done, although not at Frieze, but we have done, for example, Jake and Dina Chapman did an extraordinary project where they painted people's portraits that became an installation that was in their Take Liverpool show. I think our strategy tends to be, we show the range of art that we, an artist that we work with, and we want to showcase that. And you know what the breadth of what the gallery is and who it works for. I think that sometimes, and I'm not being critical, I like it when galleries are imaginative and experimental, but I think it's better sometimes not to overblur the distinction. exhibitions for us are fundamentally not commercial first and foremost. It's giving the artist a chance of space to do something like a punctuation point or to mark a career. And the commercial activity can follow, it can happen in back rooms, or it can be generated as a consequence of what's being done. It's not to say you don't sell from exhibitions, it's not to say you don't sell whole exhibitions, but the primary motivation is give the artist the space, be an artist-led gallery, serve their needs. Art fairs, I think, are much better if you're simply looking smartly at strategically placing work and trying to expand your client base and so on.
That was Tim Marlowe ending our highlights from our special live shows from Frieze London Art Fair. Phew, what a big week. Just listen to my voice. Up next after the break, to Chicago, where a very special radio event has been taking place.
8,760 hours, 12 months, 20 million downloads, one radio station. We're celebrating our first anniversary here at Monocle 24, so if you're interested in what Richard Branson taught us about business, or maybe you missed the time when we talked politics with Carl Bildt.
To call it an international conference, that's difficult in itself. The really difficult thing is then to start to implement the conclusions.
If you'd like to enjoy Zaha Hadid one more time, or perhaps you want to remind yourself of what happened when Kylie popped in.
It's been interesting to have a year of celebrating and digesting and looking back at all that I've done in the last 25 years.
Then don't forget, every minute of Monocle 24 is available at monocle.com, via iTunes or on our app. We look forward to bringing you many more years of great audio. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where we are 1 year old. Last week in Evanston, Illinois, hundreds of radio fans got together for the Third Coast International Audio Festival. Among them was Sylvain Gier, the co-founder and editor-in-chief of France's Radio Arte, one of the most forward-looking cultural audio offerings out there. After giving a talk on how to make radio 2.0, he caught up with Aisha Spears.
The philosophy was to use radio as a medium of creation, a medium of art. That is absolutely not sound art, which is something really specific, close to contemporary music. And it's more like painting a picture, telling a story, but using the crafty tools of radio making, which are the recording, the editing, and the mixing process. And we do that without using any music or any commentary. So there's no outside narrator. You can't hear the voice of a journalist. We cut out all the questions. So it's just people speaking for themselves and dealing with issues such as intimacy, privacy, like personal life, identity, which are something really important in the world right now. Also social and political issues, or creation in the making. Like if we would interview a sound artist, for example, we will just show him in the process of building up a piece. So it's not like straight, you know, promotional interview. It's more situations.
Here. Turkey, Ukraine, Georgia, Russia, Veliki Tornova, Bulgaria, here.
And how do you think the audience here reacted to that? Do you have a big following in the United States? And do you think there were many people in the audience yesterday who produced similar audio that as you produce?
Well, there is a revolution happening in radio now, thanks to podcast. And the good thing is that we started very early. We did podcast even before the name existed, because we started in 2002 and everything has been downloadable ever since. You know, all our PCs are freely downloadable. And the fact is that podcast is a revolution in the way that you listen to radio now. It's not something that is in the background. And it's something that really you put all your attention to it, because most people now listen to this kind of pieces through headphones. So they're highly concentrated. And to me, it's the equivalent of reading a book or a short story. In fact, a website could be called a collection of audio short stories. And these stories are either true, this is features, documentaries, and they might be false. We do jokes, sound jokes, or drama, you know, radio drama, but I think in a more modern, with a modern approach, with our editing is really influenced by some things like hip-hop or electro music. So it's kind of, at the same time, it takes its time to build the atmosphere and the character, but at the same time, it can move very fast as a, you know, very strong cuts suddenly, so that the listener doesn't get bored and can wake up, you know, in the listening process.
That was something that you mentioned yesterday, you're talking about, and I agree with you, often when you listen to drama on radio, yeah, after about 5 minutes, you just, you can't, you want to kill yourself. Yeah. Like you said, it just gets so boring so quickly. Has that been one of the hardest areas to approach it, to make it exciting for the radio listener, and how have you done that?
Yeah, absolutely. It was our main goal was to succeed in creating a radio drama that would be relevant for this generation and for today. And it is difficult because normally radio drama in Europe is really based on text and offers. You know, the offers get quite a lot, quite a bit of money to write those pieces, but then people have to be very honest and strict with the text, and we don't do that. We choose to work with authors that agree that their piece can be edited, and you know, we can take one third out of a piece for narrative reasons, for rhythm, you know, like we do a lot of comedy. And also what we did is that we did very short dramas, pieces that could stand up in 2 or 3 minutes. And in a way, it's funny because I met these American guys from the podcast The Truth. And it's quite, they have quite a similar approach. It's like they also, like us, they record on location to get rid of the studio sound of normal, you know, classical radio drama, which is, as you said, a bit boring.
First, the family, they bring the body to the grassland, and then the great Lama come and make him prayer. They have a special monk and he always got in the body.
How have you found the festival? This is your first time, yeah, to this festival. Why are you here, and what's your experience been so far?
Well, I'm in kind of a huge world tour now in 2012 because this is our 10th anniversary, and so I have the opportunity to be invited everywhere. And it's my first time at Firth Coast, and I really enjoy it because in Europe there is a strong tradition of radio creation, but people are over 50, you know, the radio makers. And now there's a young generation emerging, but it's difficult for them to find work. And arteradio.com offers some of these people, not all of them because we can't, but the possibility to start and to get paid for their work. And here I see a bunch of really cool young people. They're really into it and they grew up with the internet, obviously. So their approach to radio is now an approach with that is based on podcast, in choosing creation, choosing quality over, you know, big commercial long sessions.
That's something I was surprised by yesterday when we walked into that speed dating session when neither of us knew what to do really. 3 out of 4 people that I sat down with were teenagers or, yeah, undergraduate students. They were here, they had worked really hard to get sponsorship, to come to the festival and meet people like you and talk about what they're doing and learn more. Is that something you see happening in France as well?
Oh yeah, exactly. Now in France, all the good festivals, the good radio festivals and the good radio organizations are run by teenagers, and they are volunteers. They don't get money out of it. They're at college or whatever, and they try to do that. And this is why I think it's a generation that is unlike my generation, because I'm over 45. They are so fed up with images and they don't relate to television anymore. If you go to a teenager's room now, you won't see any television or any stereo for that matter. You will only have a laptop, and they're kind of fed up with images, and they're kind of fed up with, like, you know, looking at what everybody's looking at the same time. They don't want Michael Jackson put down their throat. So they try to find this niche where they can express themselves. And radio art, radio creation is something really interesting because people are not afraid of a microphone as they can be of a camera. And you don't judge people by their the color of their skin or their attitude or whatever. You just judge them by what they say. And they can express themselves freely about their social conditions or their intimacy again. And with, in a way, protecting their identity and their personality. And so in the age of Facebook and whatever, I think radio has something to bring to this generation.
Arte, Radio, www.radioasamedium.com.
That was Sylvain Gier catching up with Aisha Spears at the Third Coast Radio Festival in Chicago. Still to come in part two of this first birthday show, we'll hear some more of that special Midori House session from New Look. We'll hear how Chinese cinema is making an impact at the Busan Film Festival. We'll hear what stories were told at the Storytelling Conference in New York City. And Book Corner is back. Oh yes, it's true. All coming up right here on Culture on Monocle 24. So without further delay, here's another birthday session track. This is New Look with Teen Need.
So you at the party. You were standing all alone. Did you see me dancing? I was trying to turn you on. Do you want my number? I'll be waiting by the phone. We're meant to be together. I already know that you. I'll say, come over, then you show up and stay forever. Hardcore metaphor, I just can't wait no more. You better come knock down my door before I hurt myself. It makes me ache, this heartbreak, I just can't take. There's no escape, hardcore metaphor.
That was New Look performing Teen Need for us here at Midori House, and you're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bound. For our next birthday treat, we're off to Asia's largest film festival, which has just wrapped up in South Korea. The 17th Busan International Film Festival rolled out the red carpet for some of the region's biggest names in showbiz and screened some of Asia's newest titles. It's also a place for up-and-coming filmmakers to get their start and attract attention outside of Asia. Reporter Jason Struther dropped off on BIFF, as it's known, and sent this report from Busan.
The Busan Film Festival has gone through a lot of changes over the years. For starters, it used to be known as the Busan International Film Festival, but I guess BIFF sounds a lot nicer than PIFF. And until this year, Korean films were always given the top slots, but not so anymore. On the festival's opening night, the Hong Kong crime flick Cold War had its world premiere. It's directed by Sunny Luk and Long Man Leung. Since its start, BIFF and Korean cinema have had a symbiotic relationship, but now some industry watchers say the festival is trying to present a more regional image. Stephen Kremen is CEO of Film Business Asia.
We report on and document what's happening in Asian cinema, particularly East Asian cinema and South Asian cinema. I came the first edition in 1996, and at that time, Korean cinema was not well known internationally, apart from a few directors. And I'd say this festival was very instrumental in helping to establish the wave of Korean cinema from the late 1990s and establishing directors like Kim Hee-duk, Park Chan-wook, that we know internationally now.
Kremen says, basically, Korean directors don't really need Busan anymore. They can have their films premiere in Cannes or other huge festivals. But nevertheless, some of the films receiving the most buzz at the 2012 BIFF were homegrown ones. Director Chung Ji-young takes questions after the screening of his latest film, National Security, It's a gritty flick that takes you inside the mind of a torture victim, as well as the person carrying out the punishment. It's a relevant issue in South Korea this year, since the daughter of a former dictator, who wasn't so shy about torturing his opponents, is running for president. While Korean films still can pack a punch at the festival, it is a Chinese actress whose name is on everyone's lips. Tang Wei, best known for her role in Ang Lee's 2007 film Lust Caution, has been chosen to host the 2012 festival. She turned 33 years old while in town, and fans have reportedly been serenading her on Busan's Haeundae Beach. Her selection as MC might have something to do with the growing importance of the Chinese film market and industry. And as Stephen Krimen explains, China's rise, whether it be in cinema or anything else, is the most interesting story in Asia.
So this year in China, they producing something like 500 films. These are films with a film license from the government. And beyond that, there are, you know, additional 100, 200 documentaries and features that you'd call underground features, not submitted to the government censorship process. And of course, this festival is showing maybe 20 Chinese films. So it really cannot represent or hope to represent in that number. It is showing a range in that it's showing a new blockbuster martial arts fantasy movie called Dai Qi that just opened in China. It's showing Dangerous Liaison, which is also now playing in China, which is a remake of the French novella. It's showing one other film called Full Circle, which has not played many festivals yet. It's starting to launch internationally, which is a road movie about old people in old folks' home who escape for one final trip. That released in early May in China. You know, China is so exciting right now. It's the most dynamic cinema in the region. And this year has been very exciting in terms of genre cinema. There's a whole range of genres exploring, like horror and westerns and noir in Chinese cinema. And that's not reflected in Busan. But then again, it's not reflected in any other festival either, apart from perhaps the Shanghai Festival in June.
But aside from the blockbusters that are coming out of powerhouse production companies in China, Japan, and Korea, BIFF still gives a lot of space for independent films from Asian countries without a lot of support in the industry.
There is a world of hide and seek, awaiting to be discovered through a telescopic vision. Television. A film by Mustafa Sarwar Farooqi.
The Bengali film Television is actually a BIFF success story. The producers once came to Busan looking for funding and received backing at the Asia Project Market, or APM. The market, located nearby BIFF's main stage in a convention center, is where deals go down and Asian filmmakers connect with buyers and distributors pick up work that might have gone unnoticed overseas. Nam Dong Chol heads the Asia film market.
Busan became the window of Asian cinema. Investors or producers attend our APM, and then they could introduce the project to the world, the other side of the world.
Spread across the floor of the convention center are booths set up by filmmakers and producers from all across Asia. I see a lot of representation from Japan. There's some Taiwanese and Hong Kong production companies. And for the first time, the government of Thailand has set up a pavilion. They perhaps have the best piece of real estate here. They're located right as you walk through the door into the convention center.
Hi, my name is Tong. I'm the coordinator from the National Federation of Thai Film Associations. And yeah, I'm coming here with along with more than 20 Thai film and animation companies to promote and, you know, exhibit our projects.
How's it going so far? Any of the filmmakers having some luck finding distributors?
Yeah, there's so many buyers, distributor that came visit our booths, and you know, many of them interested in animation, many of them interested in like romantic comedy films or horror films, always famous horror films. Yes.
The Central Asian Republic of Kyrgyzstan doesn't have a pavilion at the market, but some of its filmmaking talent are present. There's one Kyrgyz film called Lenin, which on paper is followed by a question mark, then an exclamation point, that is attracting attention. This trailer is pretty much all that exists of Lenin at the moment, but production may get off to a good start soon. APM has given the producers $10,000 to make the film happen. Murat Elikov is director of the Project Lenin.
To sum it up in short, it's a story about three punk kids in a small town who steal a statue of Lenin to try and sell it for the worth of the metal it's made from. I've been very pleased by the attention that we've been getting from various producers and people in the industry who we've had talks with. Everyone seems very excited about the project. Which gives me hope that we will be able to make the film in the way that we originally wanted to. Ideally, it would be really good to finish the project and finalize it, and maybe even hopefully be able to screen it at the next Busan Festival.
Namdong Chol of the Asia Film Market is also confident that Lenin will be coming back to Busan soon. He says giving an outlet for Asian talent is one of the central purposes of BIFF.
We are getting better and better and bigger. Market should be a bridge between director and industry, or producer and distributor. We would like to be a bridge between them.
For Monocle in Busan, I'm Jason Strother.
You are listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. We're off to tell you a story in New York after this.
Second Cycle is a special kind of upscaling that understands consumers' connection to objects with a personal history. Monocle Films travel to Helsinki to watch Finnish furniture brand Artek hunt down old items and bring them back to life.
It was quite an emotional thing for all of us. When we went through the flea markets and schools and kindergartens from where we bought these things, we took them to our office and our employees started to say that, Mirko, don't do anything to them. Don't touch them, don't hurt them. Let them be as they are.
You can watch this Second Cycle film and many more films in the program's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to The Culture Show with me, Robert Bound, where we are 1 year old. Last month, we told you about the Future of Storytelling Summit, a one-day conference held at Snug Harbor in New York. Well, this past week, top thinkers from the worlds of media, filmmaking, marketing and beyond gathered together for a collaborative discourse focused on better understanding the art of communication in the 21st century, no less, and seeking an answer to the question of how digital tech is changing the way we tell stories today. We sent Monocle's Barrett Austin on a quick hop over to Snug Harbor, and here's what he heard.
The Future of Storytelling Summit made clear its ambitions were lofty, but in bringing together a diverse and talented cast of storytellers with backgrounds as disparate as neuroscientists, rock stars, filmmakers, and corporate marketing officers, the summit effectively set about understanding the way digital media has transformed the way we communicate and tell stories. Here's Brian Seth Hurst, CEO of the Opportunity Management Company, and a self-described story welder, on how he ended up at the summit and some of his thoughts on how storytelling is changing.
I received an invitation to come as an attendee, and I said to Charles, I said, this is very interesting because I just completed a study for Intel on the future of storytelling, and here's what I see is happening. And he said, oh, would you come as a speaker? And I said, absolutely. So I'm kind of here to share my experience on the conversations between the storyteller and the audience.
And the format of this conference in particular is quite unique. Do you find that thus far in the talk that you've just given and the interaction you've had that it's quite useful?
Yeah, I actually was inspired about the format because so many times you're invited to someplace and it's one way. And you know, I'm all about two-way storytelling. I'm all about the interaction between the audience and the storyteller. And just hearing different people's points of view and the way people react to new information. And I learned stuff from the group that was here today, so that was great. I mean, it was eye-opening for me, so I thought I was here to give, and I was actually here to receive at the same time, so that was wonderful.
And to ask something that's sort of topical to the overall theme of this, do you think that as a society and the way that we start communicating globally becomes more transparent, do you think that we're becoming more genuine storytellers?
Wow, that is a really interesting question. I think we will always be storytellers, and I think that if we are awake and conscious, then we'll be genuine and authentic. And I think if we're insecure, then we will try and create stories that we want the world to believe we are. So, and I think that's always been that way. I mean, that's what public relations is all about, and marketing and advertising. So it's a tough question, but I think there is the opportunity for both, just like there's always been.
And how important do you think the idea of storytelling is in problem solving today?
I think a problem is a story. And I think that storytelling gives people the chance to remember other stories and other examples of where that problem was solved. I myself am going through something right now, and the people that are around me have already been through it. So it looks like a big problem to me, but when they come and they tell me their experiences, it's not a big problem anymore. I know that I will come out the other side of it. As far as solving problems together as a society, everyone's idea or approach, you could be inspired. The only thing I think that is different is that sometimes you attack a problem, and philosophically, I think if you attack a problem, it attacks you back.
Jake Barton, principal and founder of Local Projects, was another popular face at the Future of Storytelling Summit. Barton's recent work is focused on the storytelling component of the September 11th Memorial and Museum in New York City. Barton shared his experiences of collaborative storytelling and how his team has worked with individuals from around the world to develop a collective narrative of the events surrounding 9/11. Here's Barton on his experience at the summit.
It's been an incredible array of different disciplines focused on understanding what the future of storytelling is in a time of incredible media and digital disruption. Well, I think I'm having in some ways a different experience than most people because I'm one of the presenters. So I've had mostly experiences talking to people about the work that we're doing at Local Projects and sharing the ways in which we're using new platforms to engage people and to create experiences for visitors all over the world. But it's been amazing to see the variety of different talents that can engage with the idea that we are putting forth, which is collaborative storytelling, how groups of people can tell stories together and collect together their individual experiences into a larger collective perspective and landscape. In this case, I was speaking specifically around the 9/11 Memorial Museum that we've developed a variety of different platforms for, allowing people literally all around the world to share their experiences about that day and about their reflecting on the event going forward. I think the biggest takeaway is something that we all know, but it's helpful to have it be restated, which is that the future of storytelling is applying age-old storytelling impulses that are literally hardwired into our brains and into our experiences and developing them for new platforms, which radically change the ways that we tell stories, but only continue to satisfy our urge to ingest them.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. To round off our one-year anniversary show, we'll hail the return of one of our favourite features that's been overlooked slightly by us, perhaps. To celebrate our first year on air, it's time for a book corner, and no ordinary one at that. Here, from the Frankfurt Book Fair, is a young Kiwi poet named Lucy Diver reading an excerpt from Hamish Clayton's novel Wolf, an award-winning book that came out in New Zealand last year and is being pushed at the Frankfurt Book Fair right now.
I never saw in all my wide wanderings a country so fresh, so harsh, so beauteous green. I never set foot in any country so bitter cold in the middle months, July and August, such cold bitten jewels, so they felt to us, our northern skins. That country lay in far and unstable waters. History lay in wait for that far and unstable country. Every word spoken sent like a raft of smoke onto the air of that strange country, smelled like the blood riding the breath of their great chief, fearful to us, the Southern Napoleon. Amongst ourselves, we'd taken to calling him the Great Wolf, for the men imagined him falling upon us when our backs were turned, creating a cloak of darkness, shadowy like an animal's hide, out of which he would attack, the spear in his hand like a bone, the spirit inside him burning. We knew he was coming. At the fall of the evening, we knew he was coming. We could feel his breath on the frozen air. He was an entertainment and a terror, we told beside fires, between sheets of rum, at the passing of tobacco in the evenings. Our fear held us and told us he was coming. Everything we didn't know about that country held us and told us he was coming. Out there in the night, we could hear the sounds of birds. Their sounds were strange sounds. Those nights were strange nights.
And that was Lucy Diver reading from Hamish Clayton's novel Wolf. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week we'll be back to normal, but always bigger, stronger, better, one year wiser. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where my producer was Katie Balboa and Holly Fisher provided the brawn. Time for one final song this week from the Midori House session. This is New Look with The Ballad. Thanks for listening to The Culture Show for an entire year, and here's to our next one. Bigger, faster, better, stronger for the time being. Thanks for tuning in.
Although it's hard for me to say, it's breaking my heart, but healing it away. This is the part we embrace. Come out of the dark and into the day. This is the part when everybody says they love you so. You know we love you so. To reach out and give a hand to hold, it isn't hard enough. How many times you think the world's thrown you for a roll? It happens to us all. Don't turn away, you gotta break up and give your all. This is a part you know. This is hard for us to say. It's worth your while, so listen anyway. This is the part, don't turn away. Come out of the dark, this is your day. This is a part when everybody says they love you so. You know I love you so. And all it wants for you to know that you're not alone. You aren't on your own. How many times you think the world's thrown you for a role? It happens to us all. Don't turn away, you gotta break up and give your all. This is the final. Time.